Good morning, we're back. My name is Quentin Singleton. I'm your instructor for this course for the Introduction to Sports Betting. Today we have with us a guest speaker, Mr. Greg Gemignani. Greg Gemignani's career expands and covers decades of experience in the global gaming industry, from understanding the nuances of every single variation of gaming that is out there today, and it's been there for some time, to what's taking place on the forefront of gaming across the world. Additionally, many of the things that Mr. Gemignani has been involved with include the legal and regulatory frameworks, not only in the U.S., but also globally, in helping countries set up legalized and regulated frameworks for the gambling industry. Today, we're here. We're going to look at Units 3 and 6. We're going to cover some of the jargon classifications and models that relate to gaming. We're also going to talk about some of the legal and regulatory frameworks, particularly in the U.S., but also those as they relate to the rest of the world, many of which we've seen based here on the frameworks that were established in Vegas over almost 100 years ago. So with that, let's kick off the course. Talking to Mr. Gemignani. There you go. Hint. Now we're off for the races.
Yeah, with regard to the U.S., you have different classes of gaming or gambling. And really, the term gaming was really one that was coined here in Nevada versus gambling.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
It's just basically gambling that's regulated by the state. The reason for all the different classifications or different types of classifications for gaming is that historically in the U.S., gaming was okay. Like at the time of the colonies, inception of the country, gambling was fine. It was just like anything else. And you even had state lotteries, you had private lotteries.
Poker.
The problem was they were corrupt or corrupted. And by the end of the 19th century, everything was gone except for horse racing. On track, I shouldn't say pari-mutuel, on track horse racing, mm-hmm. horse race wagering. And then you started to get carve outs from these general prohibitions, these broad prohibitions. And that's where you start getting these different classifications. So you have the skill gaming exemption in some states. And why do you have that? Well, because state fairs would have contests, animal husbandry contests, other types of contests. They wanted an exemption. Well, we never really intended to make that gambling. And so you get this exemption for bona fide contests of skill, speed, strength, and endurance. So the pie making contests and things like that, which would have small entry fees, kind of cover the illustration. And you get that in some states. Sweepstakes, get an exemption for that because we really didn't mean to cover sweepstakes, sweepstakes being no consideration required and chance and prize. And then the issue became, well, what about promotion?
That's because sweepstakes are a giveaway. So yeah, sweepstakes, because that's like a giveaway, right? It's like I'm trying to sponsor this to give you something, right? So
right. And in some states, the problem was if you did it in a commercial setting, you would have issues of like promoter benefit consideration theory, any consideration. So, for example, like the McDonald's Monopoly contest that a lot of people are familiar with, or similar contests. You buy something, you get a ticket with it, and that enters you into the drawing or the contest. And, a lot of states were okay with that. That's a promotion. You're promoting some other product. The purchase
league work.
Channel, it's not for that.
Yep.
That activity. It's not for the prize contest. You're buying a Big Mac. You're paying for a Big Mac. The price hasn't gone up. And you can enter for free.
Yep.
And then you get that sweepstakes exemption as long in a lot of states, as long as that free method meets what's called the equal dignity rule, which means that the free entries have equal dignity with entries that are associated with the purchase.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you purchase to enter, but there's some other ancillary associated purchase. And the equal dignity rule says that, basically you have to, it can't be significantly more onerous to get a free entry it has to have the same odds or same chance of winning the exact same prize as those that are associated with an ancillary purchase.
Well, what we're saying is it's okay to gamble as long as you had to buy something else, because it's all based on odds and payouts.
Well, as long as that what you're buying has nothing to do with the prize contest, and as long as you don't have to buy to enter.
Yeah, it's your classic raffle, right? In some way.
Not exactly. Raffle is just a lottery. Because raffles, you pay money. Usually you pay money for a raffle ticket. Like you go to the church, the church raffle, you pay money, you get a bunch of raffle tickets, and they pull it. It's just like a lottery.
Yeah, you're right. I was thinking like raffle in the other context, which is not technically a raffle, where you get a ticket based on purchasing something else, you drop it into the bucket, and then they pull it.
That's like a sweepstakes. As long as the price of the original goods doesn't go up, or the services, or whatever you're, you know, the Big Mac price doesn't go up, you're okay in most states. And in fact, modern view is you're probably okay everywhere. At this point in time, you know, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Walmart, ESPN, Disney, they all run sweepstakes on a pretty much regular basis. I think Walmart has a perpetual sweepstakes running if you go to their website.
Yeah.
I don't know if you use T-Mobile's phone service, but they've basically got a perpetual sweepstakes running as well, or at least they have for a while. Sony Pictures does, you know, but it's there to promote their other products. You know, it's a promotional tool. And so you get that carve out from that. And then you have sort of what some people call gray area. I don't think it's really all that great with fantasy sports, or at least daily fantasy, right? Where the argument is it's skill, even though the skill exemption was really, you know, when we were talking about the county fairs and state fairs, it's really for things that the player has control over. And I think the Texas Attorney General did a really good job of this when he issued his daily fantasy sports opinion, where he said the bona fide contest exemption is for contests, or bona fide skill contests exemption for our gambling statute is for contests where the outcome is determined by the actual inputs and outputs of the players. Mm-hmm. With fantasy, all you're doing is you're making bets like you are with sports betting. You know, you're betting on somebody else's performance. Your skill is in predicting somebody else's performance. You don't have control over that performance.
I mean, you know, I see that. I see what you're saying. But then, like, if that was the case, then coaches don't matter on teams.
Oh, sure they do.
Well, yeah.
Coaches matter for individual players, too.
Yeah.
Well, the coach,
I guess what I'm saying is, like, the ability to select players to build a roster in the real life is akin to the history of where fantasy came from.
Except for you, when you're building your fantasy roster, you're not saying that, you know, let's take Aaron Jones as a running back. You're the coach. You decide when Aaron Jones goes in and comes out. As a fantasy player, I don't.
Yeah, you roll over that. Have removed. Yeah.
I'm just prognosticating, just like I would if I picked on the game or bet a prop bet on Aaron Jones' running statistics.
Well, what about the, like, I get what you're saying. What about all the laws that passed before PASPA came down around fantasy throughout the U.S., right? And some of those, if I recall correctly, it's been a long time, they're worded fairly broadly. So,
yeah.
It captures this DFS and probably plus-plus, if I remember correctly. You're closer to it than I am.
Well, I think PASPA, I think DFS is illegal. If PASPA was still good law, it would be illegal on that. PASPA, because PASPA defined sports wagering to include the performances of one or more athletes participating in an athletic event. So PASPA clearly identified individual performances as part of sports wagering. The states, most of these DFS laws that permit some form of DFS,
sure,
were after 2015, when state's attorneys generals, 12 of them, issued opinions saying it was illegal.
That's right. That's right. It was an evolution.
So,
across the U.S., where there was this blanket, DFS is a no-go.
Exactly. And it's, you know, in places like Texas, that's still the last word. the last words of the attorney general's opinion says this is illegal gambling in Texas. In Texas, for one, the test we use to distinguish games of skill that are exempted from games of chance that are not is whether chance plays a material role.
Yeah, and I love Texas because it's this dichotomy, because poker rooms are okay.
No, they're not, actually.
I thought they were okay within a certain framework, as long as you're not taking a rake or something.
No, no. The poker exemption that gets cited is that they're just like Nevada, where we have that exemption for playing in your own house, a private residence.
Right.
That's what Texas has. It's not illegal in a private residence, provided that nobody's making any money except for the players.
That's great too. Now, maybe where this
these aren't residences anymore; they're actually clubs. And the truth is that they're
you get to rent a table so you can use it, right?
It's like they are here. I mean, if you open up a poker room here and say, "Well, it's a private residence," no, the meta gaming can come down on you. And they do occasionally. There are raids in Texas. Everyone, don't pay the sheriff and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Or don't contribute to the re-election campaign.
So they're like. I guess this is why I wanted to start with this first question. Like, what is gaming now? And you've just started scratching the surface on the variations of gaming. And nowadays, like, if you really want to start combining things, like social sweepstakes casino.
Yeah, which is interesting because it depends on how it's structured, right? You can have, I think you can have social games, right? Social casinos, I think, are fine. Yeah. They're no different than a console video game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you walk up to, date myself here, like a Pac-Man console video game, you throw in a quarter or two to play.
Yeah.
And you don't really get anything out except for additional plays, right? There's nothing marketable. And so the argument is that, yeah, there's elements of chance in there, and yeah, you do pay something. But you don't actually win anything valuable.
Yeah,
nothing valuable comes out.
You just get to keep playing.
And, you know, something like Zynga was the same. You know, you play a game on Zynga, whatever it is. You can buy Zynga bucks. You can win Zynga bucks. And you can continue playing with Zynga bucks. But the reason Zynga's not as popular anymore is people finally figured out they're not worth anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't exchange them for anything of value. You can't sell them on eBay or Craigslist. If you get caught trying to transfer your account gets nuked. You know, it's deleted. And so what ended up happening is people did end up with a billion Zynga bucks. And you know what that meant? They had a million Zynga bucks.
No. So, until you can convert it into something else, but they blocked that. There's other ecosystems where they allow the third-party conversion of use of the digital goods.
Right, and that's the problem.
Like the game doesn't make, and the game may be gaming in like the broad video game sense, but it's not necessarily gambling. But then when you can take that.
Well, early on in, I got to be careful because I can't disclose client information, but.
Now, please don't do that.
Back in 2000, there was a very popular, massive multiplayer game. It's set sort of in, you know, the world of, I don't know, yeah, like a fantasy world. And this game, I want to say it was like $60 to buy, and it was $20 a month to have access to the online system. And at one point in this game, if you were standing around a lake, the right time, facing the lake, a sword was going to pop out.
Mm-hmm.
And one person would get the sword. And it happened. So everybody's there. The sword, you know, lady of the lake tosses the sword out of the lake and somebody gets it. And what do they do with it? They go and sell it on eBay for 20 grand.
Yeah.
And that company got a letter from an attorney general's office and from a state in the northwest part of the country saying, explain to us how this isn't gambling. You pay $60 for the game. You pay $20 a month to play. You have to pay to play. You stand around a lake and randomly somebody gets a sword. And that sword's worth $20,000. And our answer was, sorry. It's like the cliche about the frogs in the water. You know, if it was boiling water, they'd jump out, but if you heat it up slowly, well, this game, you know, just kind of evolves slowly, this concept. And didn't realize that it could be viewed as gambling, but we will make sure it never happens again. And it's a that was a tough one. Now, the solution was you don't allow the digital objects to be traded. And this is kind of what happened with Valve, you know, with Steam. I mean, once you allow the trading in digital objects, they become valuable. They have some marketable value.
I was reading an article just earlier this year. This is 2024, in case this course goes on beyond 2024. But you know, I was reading an article earlier this year about one of the massive multi online games where the currency in game can still be transferred outside the game to purchase goods or to use it in some other scenario. And the article was really talking about how almost like a VIP player or hosts, VIP hosts were diving into the social channels of this particular game, encouraging those who had these whatever digital currency to be anonymous about it, to take it out and literally use it on to do an exchange for an online casino. Oh, you know, similar, right? So instead of like taking a digital good and selling it to someone who you could transfer to them, so now they have a sword in the game, still similar, but taking that or digital good, flipping it like a foreign exchange into something that is playable on a gaming type website, some sort.
And that's the issue that Valve had, right? I don't represent Valve, so this is not a client, very client privilege at all.
That was fairly widespread, and they were trying to shut it down. Remember, there were like two kids in Florida who they were the ones, there were a couple of them running the online casino.
Right, they were using skins as currency. So you could take your skins, bet them on their online skin casino. The games were rigged on top of everything else. And you had teenagers, kids buying up skins and betting them online and winning them and turning them into cash. And yeah, it was. So, I mean, I had this issue. I represented a fairly well-known football quarterback that's since retired. And when the DFS thing was booming, he had been approached by a group that wanted to use his name to promote a virtual sports book. And the way their virtual sports book worked is you would buy the virtual currency, place bets either against other players or with the house, against the house, win virtual currency, and then you could cash it out. And these whiz kids from Silicon Valley were like, "It's not gambling because it's all virtual currency." I'm like, "This is how a casino works. You walk into the cage, you get in chips, which is a virtual currency. You go bet on, you win or you lose, and then you cash out." "Well, no. This is virtual currency." Like,
It's not physical, it's digital.
just describe a casino. You know, you better.
Remember always that first sim and they had a casino in it?
Yeah.
Way back in the day.
There was a massive move. You know, predating the metaverse, something similar where they had that issue. The massive virtual world, and I
Yeah,
guess
some of the
they
first
call
ones ever.
property. I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about. And they had casinos there for a while. They had the block use of the in-game currency from casinos, so you couldn't cash anything out or win anything of value. But yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, talking about the metaverse, you know, some of this stuff is global. I actually have a US versus international question around this too. Because a lot of what we're talking about is like a little bit of the evolution of the US specifically, all these evolving models or definitions of what is gaming. But one of the more recent ones is like in the metaverse, right? So you can buy all these digital goods and whatever, you're in this thing. But in this case, it was to play in a casino in this metaverse using a cryptocurrency. But the only way you could play like other NFTs, you had to effectively buy an NFT. The NFT, based on what you buy, gave you the right to play the game. And then there was like a second step to it, is that, you know, It was, the theory was is that the NFT you bought gave you access to play the game over a certain period of time. And because that's how you access the game, when you use your cryptocurrency or your in-game currency to play the casino game and eventually cash out back into crypto, therefore it wasn't gambling. I'm not saying it full of water or held water.
No.
It was like this weird gating theory that if you buy an NFT to gate like a
Or you're like a cover charge to get into a casino, like they have in Singapore. Yeah. No,
That's right.
if it's got value, I get this question all the time. I want to open up a sports book and I want it to be I want to base it on Ethereum and use crypto. And it's not because I'm using crypto, right? I need a letter that says that. And no, I mean, Ether has value. It's a marketable value to Ether.
What about the sports player exchanges? You know, the player indexes. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, just please correct me if I'm saying the wrong acronyms here, but I want to say the CFTC recently ruled that they do not want to govern, if you will, it's not betting, but making decisions, allowing people to make decisions on politics and weather and things like that under the CFTC guise, right? I thought that recently put out a rule saying, no. Although we have broad definitions of what we oversee, we're going to tell you like this is we're not going to do. But similarly, you have like player indexes where games are tied to creating a player value in dollars based on their statistical performance, and then you trade those like you do stocks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have these old laws called bucket shop laws
That's right.
that probably violates those. But no, we haven't seen any enforcement of bucket shop laws in decades. Maybe,
Law
maybe.
enforcement probably doesn't even know what they are. They're like, what?
No, I'm sure
It's not
most
on my
law
radar.
doesn't even know the laws that are out there like that. But it'd be a bucket shop. You're trading it like a commodity, but it's not.
Yeah.
But you see this, there's the new wave of fantasy sports sites that are, essentially parlay prop betting, indistinguishable from parlay prop betting.
So then, when you compare the U.S. to international, I had someone say to me once, I mean, I'm in a similar conversation. They're in London, I'm here in Vegas. And so we're talking about these distinctions. And they go, that's just a U.S. thing. You guys just make it way too complicated. We don't have these kind of conversations over here.
No, they
Do
don't.
you think that, like, what do you think about that dichotomy? Like, I mean, there's,
It's because we come from different gaming prohibitions, regulations come from a different place in the US than they do in Europe, the UK in particular. In the UK, the fundamental reason for regulation is player protections, consumer safety. In the US, it isn't. It is a policy consideration. The primary policy consideration is to prevent criminal organizations from profiting from gambling. Mean, that's why our processes are so different. I'm sure you've represented foreign applicants in US gaming, getting licensing. And no matter how much you tell them, it's much more rigorous, it's much more difficult. They don't believe you. Oh, we're regulated. We're regulated in the UK. We're regulated in Malta. I'm like, it doesn't even scratch the surface of what we do here because
Of the legacy history.
our history is different. Our primary policy reason that created this system, and the truth is, in the US, Nevada was one of one in 1931. It was one of one in 1959.
Yeah.
It almost got shut down in 1961, and it was one of one. And other states followed it, either in whole or in part, the Nevada system because it worked. Nevada system was built on strict regulation and on preventing people with ties to organized crime or criminal activity or unsuitable or unsavory elements from participating in Nevada gaming. And why did we do that? Because the federal government was going to shut us down. And for anybody that's ever flown to Nevada, especially if you've flown to Las Vegas, as you're flying in, take a look around. You're not going to see anything green. You're not going to see a lot of water. You're not going to see a lot of population. We can't fall back on agriculture. Illinois can fall back on agriculture. We don't have a lot of water for manufacturing. We're not going to fall back on manufacturing. Gaming and tourism is our primary source of revenue for the state, to fund the state. I know sales tax is the primary or the largest revenue generating tax in the state, but who do you think pays a lot of that tax?
Course.
Right? I mean, so gaming and tourism is a cornerstone of our economy here, and we had to protect it. And in order to protect it, we had to come up with a scheme that would keep the federal government from shutting us down. And this is a scheme that guys like Bob Fess and Grant Sawyer came up with to keep the feds off our back. I'm sure you know the story. JFK gets elected day after his inauguration in 1961. Bobby Kennedy becomes the attorney general. So, a month or two after Bobby becomes attorney general, he hires 50 federal agents to work in Nevada, and they're training to shut down every gaming facility in Nevada. Grant Sawyer gets wind of this. Grant had supported Jack Kennedy in the primaries in 1960, in 1959, and he flew out to D.C., went to talk to Bobby Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy told him to go pound sand. And left with no other option, he went and talked to the president, who happened to be his friend, because he had helped. They're roughly the same age, same generation. But he also helped him in the primary. And he said, give me some time. I'm not saying you don't do it. I'm just saying give us time to let the new regulatory system work. And he got that time. JFK gave him the time, called his brother off. And we were literally that close to losing gaming here in Nevada. Now, because that worked out, and again, at the time, gambling in Nevada was thought of in a worse light than prostitution in Nevada was thought of in the rest of the nation. It was a pariah activity. People couldn't believe that Nevada would permit such debauchery. It was a stain on the country, and the public sentiment was very, very much against it. In part because of the Kieffer hearings and the McClellan hearings. These are Senate hearings that delved into organized crime and largely delved into organized crime and gambling. That became sort of the must-see TV of the 1950s. It was the existential threat that would end the American way of life. The Kieffer hearings had higher ratings than the World Series did.
Well, I mean, weren't those Kieffer hearings at the former post office downtown, now museum?
That was one of the places they held them. They were primarily held in D.C.
Yeah, they still have the courtroom there to visit, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, they did a traveling show as well, where they went to New York, they went to Miami, they went to Chicago, they went to Las Vegas. But the primary venue was actually D.C.
So is that why we use the term gaming? So I was, growing up in the industry, I was always under this impression that part of the reason we use gaming over gambling is that for a long time there was a negative connotation, even when I got into the business, that gambling was a bad thing.
Oh, it's still.
I didn't even know it any different than gambling's gambling, right? You grow up in the city and you go to breakfast at the casino, right? I mean, that's just what everyone did, right? So, I'd always been told in part that gaming was a different way to approach it as a topic to people, because these are in fact games. And whether you're playing Monopoly with dice, right, whether you're playing a pinball machine, or whether you're playing nowadays an online video game, or an online video game with poker built in, or an online video game with a race built in, or whatever it may be, right? There's this gamification of so many different things, and those underlying gaming rules and the way the game is designed and the randomness created in the game. Is someone going to jump out of me? Is there going to be a car crash in front of me? All these different things impact this broader world of gaming. So I use gaming generally speaking, but I end up finding out, and explain myself all the time, oh, you're in the gaming industry. First, everyone says, oh, you do video games. Well, not really, but so I mean, is that part why there's been this nomenclature of gaming for the broader
Yeah.
gambling industry?
I think primarily it was to distinguish regulated gambling from gambling in general. Because in every state, gambling is illegal. In Nevada, gambling is illegal. This is a misconception, particularly with people over from overseas, outside the United States. Gambling is illegal in Nevada, unless you have a license to do so, and then with it's only permitted within the scope of that license. So, you know, a lot of, I get calls all the time, well, gambling's legal there, I'm just going to come bring my product and run it out of Nevada. Well, no, you're not. You know, if you want a sports book license, you know, under Nevada law, you have to have your primary book in the same location that you operate more than 15 slot machines and or table games. Well, what do I have to do for that? Well, you either have to find a grandfathered location or you have to build a hotel casino resort.
Yeah.
And you have to build that hotel casino resort. If it's in the Las Vegas area of Clark County, it has to be built in a gaming enterprise district. Yeah. And you're probably not going to find one available or land available in the gaming enterprise district. So you're going to need to get the gaming enterprise district changed. So all in, you're online sports book that you think you can operate out of Nevada is going to cost you a lot more than you ever dreamed it would cost. And that's the reality of it. But again, gambling is illegal everywhere in the United States. But then there is an exemption for those with licenses to do it within the confines of the license. And that's another issue we have. We were talking about differences between the rest of the world and the U.S. is, you know, particularly with regard to sports wagering, there is no U.S. market. It doesn't exist. There's a Nevada market. There's an Illinois market. There's a New York market. There's a New Jersey market. There is a state-by-state market. But getting into one state doesn't give you access to the United States. It gives you access to that state. And if it's tribal, it gives you access to that tribe. And in a few states, it may give you access to the broader state at large. Yep. Michigan's a good example. Florida, we'll see what happens there. But
so like in that context, especially as everything is moving totally digital, right?
Well,
and when you look at game types, whether it's like a social, whether we need these classifications or not, I guess the question, but in that kind of like strict sense, regardless of where you're playing these games in the world, social games served up in the United States, although they may be considered as a category social here, they're served up all over the world quite fine because they're digital, right? So, but just for categorizational purposes, we have a category for them. But social versus skill versus gambling versus sweepstakes, all these different models, do you think they still matter at this point? I mean, they're...
Yeah, because if you violate the law, there's a risk of going to jail or paying fines. You know, there are still outstanding indictments for people involved in the online poker industry. You know, if you change planes in a U.S. airport somewhere, you're going to get arrested. Post 9/11, everything's connected.
But like, if you play some of these games online, they play just like the games you would play at a casino in some instances, but the underlying mechanics are slightly different. But the user experience, technology to the point where you go the other way, if you go back in time and you're playing a game in person, it's very clear what roulette is. Versus craps, versus poker, versus a slot machine. And then as things have moved digitally, you could be playing something that looks like roulette, like you're in a Vegas casino on the floor, but the underlying mechanics in terms of how you got there, and in the strictest sense, may not be technically traditional gambling mechanics, but the game plays like that.
Well, it's, well, I mean, again, you go back to the primary elements of most forms of gambling, consideration, chance, and prize. And if you've got all three elements, it's going to be a gambling game. And then the question is, do the mechanics alter that? And maybe they do. You know, if it's a sweepstakes and you don't have any consideration required and it meets the equal dignity rule, which basically takes the profit motive out for the most part, then it might be fine. Or it could be a form of regulated game. It could be underneath, you could have, you know, pari-mutuel tickets for horse racing. But the display of whether you've won on that ticket or not is a roulette game display. Yeah, but there really is no random outcome. The random outcome was determined by the horse race. And in a lot of states, betting on horses is legal. Even betting on horses online is legal. Not every state, but a lot of states.
So you think this distinction still matters? I guess I was asking from like even like a player perspective, it's sometimes indistinguishable.
Well, from a player perspective, it probably is somewhat irrelevant. From an operator standpoint, it's relevant because you can get arrested for it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's fair.
That's the issue, right? That's the only issue. And really with any gaming product or game product, you've got two issues of risk. You got the legal risk and then the risk of enforcement. You know, DFS is a great example. Texas DFS is a great example. Clearly, there's a legal risk. The attorney general has said it's illegal in Texas. And if you look at the case law in Texas, you know, that's a state where it uses the any chance test or material element test. So chance plays any role to game of chance. Fair enough. The attorney general explained the exemption, the skill gaming exemption, which is consistent with the case law there too, and issued an opinion saying that it's illegal. So legally, it's high risk. Risk of enforcement? No.
So I've seen, like, in terms of categorizations of other countries, it's usually broken down between land-based and digital.
Pretty simple.
What's the channel? And then it's like betting, which generally refers to like sports betting and sometimes horse race and other animal, you know, animal sports you can bet on. And then casino. Is that, from your recollection, is that pretty much it? Like, I mean, generally speaking, like we look at other jurisdictions around the world, it's, there's more distinctions than that, but I tend to remember.
Yeah, but again.
Channel and like A or B or both.
No, I think that's probably right. But again,
the horse lottery too. There's always lottery. Lottery has its own.
Yeah. And the policy reasons behind it are different. You know, like, you know, we said in the U.S., Nevada in particular, it was to keep bad people out. Mm-hmm. Keep people that were going to screw up the entire industry out. You know, so that was our policy. In the U.K., it's consumer protection. If you ever get a business card from one of the U.K. gaming regulators, it's right on the consumer protections, right on their business cards.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But for a lot of jurisdictions, particularly some of those in the Caribbean, the issue isn't either of those. It's revenue generation and business development. And that's the primary policy reason for allowing it and regulating it. Well, to the extent it's actually regulated. In a lot of jurisdictions, it really isn't actually regulated. It's called regulation, but there's no
post license enforcement or oversight.
No, and there's no pre license enforcement or oversight either. Anybody can get a license as long as you pony up the money. As long as you're willing to pay the fees, as long as you're willing to locate some assets there, you can get a license.
Are you up to speed on the Antigua and Barbuda WTO dispute with the United States?
The U.S. has been ignoring that for years. I think that Antigua Barbuda have a $20 million copyright judgment that they can skirt $20 million worth of U.S. copyright law. And the idea there was to get content companies like Disney and Sony and others to put pressure on the U.S. to let them in. Now, having read the problem with the WTO decision is that the U.S. didn't participate at all. So it's essentially a default.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that's in the Antiguan briefs is just flat out wrong. I mean, it's you know, the description of what the U.S. legal market is like is just flat out wrong.
Well, I believe focused on online horse racing, right? If I recall
correctly. Which, again, is still regulated at a state-by-state level.
It's not licensed. Yeah. It's either it's not permitted and you can't do it.
Yeah, and it's not like the U.S. favors U.S. horse racing operators. I mean, you were in the business. We take bets on Turfway. As I recall, Turfway is located in Canada. It's not here.
Okay.
They play by the same rules everybody else does.
Yep.
So there, it's not like Antigua was shut out of the market because they were Antiguan. They were shut out because they don't want to get licensed where, you know, and the U.S. doesn't have a national license. We don't have we don't really have a national policy on gaming. And that's kind of why PASPA was overturned, right? And if you read the opinion, they said, well, it's commandeering because you're forcing states to enforce a policy that the federal government hasn't even articulated itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. The federal government hasn't articulated. What we've articulated is gaming is a state, primarily a state issue. And with the exception of sports wagering, it stays as a state-by-state issue. And with sports wagering, you got the Wire Act that prohibits the interstate transmission of sports wagering information, essentially, and clearly has no exemption for the transmission of bets across state lines. But other than that, it's up to the states. And even with that, it's still up to the states. You know, it's up to the states if they want to have, I mean, we have what, 32 states now that have the federal legal regulated sports wager within their borders?
Yeah,
that's shocking. I never thought that would happen.
Yeah, post-PASPA, I was always saying, and I revised it a little bit, but I've always been saying, like, this will be the largest expansion of regulated gaming that we'll probably see in our lifetime from either a numbers perspective, right? I mean, I think directionally that's correct. I mean, we went from, what were we pre-PASPA Nevada, $500 million in revenue? No, we had to be the
No. Your former employer was over there.
Yeah. No, not handle revenue.
Oh, yeah.
No. Handle, we were in the billions here, statewide. Yeah. I think revenue was probably around statewide $300 million, if I can recall correctly. And then again, Oregon, Montana, and Delaware didn't really count with their sports lotteries, if you will.
No, I mean, Oregon pulled their product. Delaware brought theirs back in 2009.
Right.
It was three-team NFL only. In Montana, I think it was Charitable Calcutta pools with severe limits on how much you could wager and severe limits on the prize amount.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't popular, right?
Yep.
Didn't.
And then we went from that to whatever we're on track to do this year, $10 billion or something like that in revenue.
Yeah. I think you can credit DFS for a lot of that.
Yep. Yeah.
Let's face it, DFS is sports betting.
People will debate that. We don't have to
debate. Yeah, you can debate it, but...
We can debate it.
You know...
I remember working with some of the earliest DFS companies way back in the day when DFS was a new thing. And you're trying to, like, understand the games and figure out where, you know, where does the puzzle fit,
Yeah, the skill used in DFS is the same skill you use in betting in a sports book.
Yeah.
I mean, the argument that the reason you had the exemption for fantasy sports under the UIGEA, the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, which doesn't make fantasy sports legal, by the way. It just says that if it meets this criteria, that even if it's illegal under other laws, it won't be illegal under this one as well.
So are you saying by inserting a definition in a federal statute doesn't by default make that legal?
No, I think exactly, because the statute itself says that. The very first part of the UIGEA says that this law shall not, I could pull it up, shall not extend, limit. Basically, it doesn't change the nature of the activity. It only prohibits the funds transfers received in furtherance. Yeah. It's saying, even if it's illegal under other laws, like, for example, I think it's either South Dakota or maybe it's North Dakota. One of the Dakotas, I believe, has had a fantasy sports law on the books forever, since before 2015, at least. And one of the things is, one, it has to be run on a parimutuel system.
Oh, yes, I remember this one.
Yeah, let's see the amount the promoter can make. And it prohibits the use of telephone or electronic communications to conduct the activity.
It was basically dead on arrival.
Well, it's law. I mean, it's been law there
I remember trying to launch a fantasy sports game. I want to say in North Dakota under that law, but like it was just trying to like make a game work within that framework. And although it sounds like it's okay, this like creates a lot of barriers to people wanting to play.
Yeah, and a lot of the fantasy sports sites don't exclude that state.
Yeah.
And So let's say you get, let's say the business gets charged for violating Montana's, or I'm sorry, not Montana, North Dakota's prohibition on, or North Dakota's law on fantasy sports. No electronic, has to be pari mutuel. So you violate that statute. You violate that statute, you've probably violated the Illegal Gambling Business Act.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't face the UIGEA charge, right? Because it falls under the exemption of the UIGEA. But the UIGEA exemption is only for the UIGEA, and that's what we pull up the UIGEA interpretive portion.
Maybe for the listeners, we could step up the framework and I'll describe it while you're pulling that up. But you have this multi-tiered framework within the United States where you've got federal laws, which generally preempt state. Historically, with respect to gaming, gambling, whatever we want to call this thing, and all those things that exist within it, sweepstakes, fantasy, social, whatever, generally covered under state laws in terms of what's permitted or prohibited. But then at the federal law, there's these laws that say, but if it's illegal under the state, then by the way, here's all these other laws that now apply to you in terms of law enforcement and penalties.
Yeah, essentially.
That fair? Is that a fair way to still describe it?
Yeah, I'd say most federal laws elevate state gambling law crimes conducted in interstate commerce to federal crimes as well. Here's the UIGEA rule of construction. This is 31 USC 5361B. No provision of this subchapter shall be construed as altering, limiting, or extending any federal or state law or tribal state compact prohibiting, permitting, or regulating gambling in the United States.
We'll have changed it. We're just talking about for payments. And if you are not permitted,
Exactly.
if you're not permitted in the place you're doing the thing you're doing, you can't take payments from financial institutions in the U.S.
You, at least it won't be a crime to accept those payments if you fall under one of the exemptions. Now, you'll still be illegal under these other laws, but you won't face, this is a piling on statute, right? You're going to be doing something else that's illegal and then taking funds in advance of that illegal activity. But if it's illegal under another law and it falls in one of our exemptions, well, it might still be illegal under those other laws, but you're not going to face the added piling on charge of accepting funds in furtherance of that illegal activity.
This, if I recall, was the last in addition to the Safe Port Act.
Yes. And it was an interim version of the law. Great story. So it's 2006. If you remember, 2006, George Bush was president. He's in his second term. There's an election going to happen in 2008. The economy's humming along. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is in the betting parlors of the UK, the odds-on favorite to be the next president of the United States. But he's got a problem, and the Republican Party has a problem. Now they've got both houses or both chambers of the Congress. They control the House, they control the Senate, and they control the White House. So you pretty much do what they want. But they had a problem, and that problem was Jack Abramoff, because Jack Abramoff had corrupted Congress, and he was tight with Tom DeLay, the high-ranking Republican member of the House. And Jack Abramoff was representing offshore casinos. So they came up with this America's Moral Rights Agenda. Sort of like follow on to the Contract with America that that congressman from Georgia, Newt Gingrich, put forth. So same kind of idea. And they laid out these principles that they were going to get done. One of them was to address online gambling. And they couldn't get this through. They couldn't get it through. The banks were opposed to it because the banks are the primary enforcers. And it died. But Bill Frist, again, this is the last day of the session in 2006. You're going to go home and you're going to campaign for the election in November, the end of September. So basically, you're going to get 30 days to go out and campaign, maybe a little less. And it's an anti-terrorism bill. Nobody's going to vote against it. It's after midnight, by the way. And Congress doesn't have to actually pull the plug on the clock like they do in Nevada to make it legal. But he's looking for somebody to pick this up, and all he could find, I mean, nobody would touch it except for a congressman from northern Wisconsin who was pushing this thing called the Safe Port Act, which was an act to require fissile detection equipment in all of our ports. So that, and the issue there was, again, we're 4 years or 5 years removed from 5 years removed from 9/11. Terrorism's still, you know, on everybody's mind. And the thought was is that a terrorist organization could put a dirty bomb in a container somewhere overseas, get it to Long Beach or New York or New Jersey or Florida, California, Washington State, something like that. The dirty bomb would go off in a population center and wreak havoc. So we're going to put fissile detectors, detection equipment in all the ports. Well, the problem with that is that you know who hates that is the ports. Because it's expensive, it's sensitive equipment, and it's going to slow the ports down to a crawl. And it requires a lot of expertise. So it became advisory that they were going to advise. And I don't know if you remember this also, but the ports had an issue at this point in time too, because the ports were now owned in large part by countries in the Middle East, including the country where most of the 9/11 hijackers came from. So the ports were under some fire. But they were able to get a change to kind of advisory. And then Frist got, I think it was Sensenbrenner from Northern Wisconsin to take the bill on and tack the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act to the Safe Port Act. They did it. They voted on it. Nobody read it. It turned out to be an interim version of the bill, not the one that was actually passed by the House in the summer. And you can tell because it uses ambiguous language that they cleaned up, actually, at some point in time. But if you look at the definition of a bet and 5362 1A means the risking or staking or risking by a person of something of value upon the outcome or contest of others, subject to chance. And then B, it includes the purchase of a chance or an opportunity to win a lottery, which is predominantly subject to chance. So you got subject to chance or predominantly subject to chance. Now that gets cleaned up later, but not in the bill that got passed.
All right.
And the commentators, including somebody that we used to work with that was great guy, dynamite guy, were commenting on the bill using that summer version the next day after this thing passed.
Oh, man.
And it turned out they were all wrong because it had other things in it, too, that people were commenting on. But when you finally saw this, because it didn't make it on Thomas or the Congress website or anything like that, for a while. So it gets passed because who the hell's going to vote against an anti-terrorism bill 5 years after 9/11 on the last day of the session before you go back to campaign for the November election that occurs on the first Tuesday in November? Nobody. Absolutely nobody votes against this thing. But nobody read it either.
Yeah, that's what I recall.
So that's what you get with the UIGEA. The exemption for fantasy sports came about because people in Congress were playing. It was an office activity back in 2006.
I wonder about those conversations. You would walk into a legislator's office and say, look, we have this situation where there's this thing called fantasy sports. Have you heard of it? Well, yeah, of course I have. We all play fantasy. Well, there's this situation where in your jurisdiction, in your state, fantasy could be considered illegal because it's kind of a mixture of games and statistics. And there's a bunch of old laws on the books that somehow kind of get their arms around this thing. And then you saw a wave of states changing the frameworks at the state level to say, we're going to make sure it's codified that we've enacted a law that says fantasy is legal. And then those fantasy laws were written in a way to allow for breadth and scope as opposed to like very specific. I mean, I think UIGA is probably, if I remember correctly, more specific than many of the state laws. So, talking about framework for the audience, it's like we've got federal and state, and then in state you have, depending on when they did it, different mini or sub frameworks around game types. And it's chop. And then don't forget, we still have also the NIGC and the tribal frameworks because they're sovereign nations within the U.S. as well. Very interesting stuff happening in Florida.
Yeah.
terms of like what can be done under these tribal compacts, which again are referenced in Yuiga. We probably have like one of the more complex regulatory frameworks.
I mean, the primary source of gaming law is at the state level.
Yeah.
And then it's at the tribal level. And then it's at the federal level. And it's another misconception you get from people that are, particularly those that are not from the U.S., where, I mean, I worked on a matter where a U.K. company with a Maltese operation did a deal with a tribe in a rural part of a very large state to operate their sports book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and their view was, hey, we're getting access to the U.S. market. I said, no, you're getting access to this tribal market. And they're like, what?
Well,
and they paid a huge upfront fee. And I said, you know, you've got access. And they're like, well, we were just going to add the U.S. to our Maltese servers. I'm like, no,
they were probably thinking of a jurisdiction very close by that the tribal jurisdiction there, more or less, you can do an entire country facing operation.
No, they thought that there was a U.S. market. And as long as you had the license somewhere in the U.S., you had access to the entire U.S.
Okay, they weren't specifically focused on a license, but the tribe gives me U.S. access, where in other countries I've seen that there is this framework where if you get a tribal license in the country, you can do countrywide. U.S. is not like that.
No.
We're not 50 states in a territory. We're 50 states of territory and hundreds of tribal jurisdictions, particularly when it comes to gaming.
And the tribal's going to get interesting, too, because the Supreme Court's kind of tinkering with tribal rights.
Totally.
And we'll see where that ends up, because technically, the tribes don't own the land that they're on. The federal government does. They occupy the land. They have a right to occupy the land. They have a right to the resources on the land, and they have the right to govern themselves to some extent. But they don't actually own the land.
What's it technically called? Held in trust?
Yeah. Yeah, it's federal land. And with the current Supreme Court, that's a whole other area of law, but
well, just on that note, just to kind of close off PASPA, the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act, for the listeners, is that the Supreme Court, PASPA was a federal law. PASPA more or less said states cannot.
And tribes.
Yeah, states cannot legalize sports betting. Technically, it was like states cannot expand sports betting from where they were at the time it was enacted. Right? I think that's like a little bit more accurate, but
yeah.
You can't do sports betting.
It prohibited states from authorizing, regulating, and permitting others, or I should say, it prohibited states, tribes, and U.S. territories from authorizing, promoting, advertising, or allowing anybody else to do that with sports wagering, unless. And then it had a couple of carve-outs. And one was if the state actually offered sports wagering between, I think it was 1976 and 1982.
So that's
the Delaware. Montana lottery and Oregon lottery exemption, because the state runs the lottery. Or if the state had it on the books and it was conducted and regulated in that state between like 1988 and 1992, that was the Nevada and Montana Calcutta pools.
Yeah.
And then there's a third exemption for any state that had casino gaming for more than 10 years, right? I should say regulated casino gaming for more than 10 years in 1982. And it passed the law within 1 year of enactment of PASPA to authorize sports betting in the casinos. And
that was
state that would qualify for that.
Jersey. Yeah, that's right.
And they didn't get their act together.
Yeah.
In part because the sponsor of PASPA was Bill Bradley, senator from New Jersey, or a senator from New Jersey, who worked tirelessly to make sure that that legislation never passed the New Jersey legislature.
Right. And then ultimately, in all bits of irony, right, it was New Jersey that ultimately challenged PASPA and said it's unconstitutional. and they, you know, button that up. So when the Supreme Court of the U.S. said, actually, we agree it's unconstitutional, which was an amazing labyrinth of legal arguments over, you know, a couple of years. But when that PASCA went away, that's what opened up this floodgate for
absolutely
all of the states to legalize sports betting. That's why we're seeing this massive expansion and focus on the U.S., because everyone's saying, well, wait a minute. If the U.S. is going to be one of the largest regulated markets in the world, I want to get in. I want a footprint. I want to be a part of this, because then we expect that there's going to be other, back to our first topic, expansions of other types of gaming.
But I think it will.
Like casino, online lottery.
It's, but again,
the game, you're actually just channel expansions. Same game, different channel.
Ultimately, yeah. And but again, it's not so much that you'll have a U.S. market. You'll still have a Nevada market.
Yeah, that's right. It's 50 plus one plus tribal. And so you end up with like hundreds of actual markets.
Yes. Right. And it has to be operated that way because of federal law.
Can you talk about, like, is where this section or US 6 is around frameworks. Can you talk about what you did in the Bahamas?
Yeah.
I think if I recall correctly, I'm not going to guess the year right, but if I tried to guess, I would say this was 2010, in that era?
2011, 2013, somewhere in there.
Okay.
2011.
Yeah, and the Bahamas wanted to redo their legislative framework, and of course then step one down, regulatory framework, right, for all things gaming. Can you describe, like, what happened? How does that look? I mean, because we were just talking about this before we hopped on. There's other countries who are coming out to UNLV and the International Center for Gaming Regulation, where both of us are. Well, I'm a guest speaker. I'm sure you're more than that. But you know, we meet with countries coming in from all over the world to learn more about regulation and how about putting a framework in place and what does licensing look like. You guys have been doing this since one of our big exports is how to legalize and regulate a country.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of having two clients that actually wanted us to draft an initial set of revised statutes for the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
Your former employer was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I actually started the job with a different client, which turned out to be, yeah, the attorney that had your former employer as his client apparently didn't run a full conflict check to find out that we were already doing that work on behalf of somebody else. Funny story, because then he came up. I mean, I ended up having to go up to meet with him, and he was livid. And I said, well, before you get too livid, take a look at what I've done. And he shipped it over to your boss, who called back and was ecstatic. The Bahamas wanted to modernize their law.
That's right.
And they allowed their licensees and participants to come up with ideas for it. And so what we did on behalf of two of those licensees ultimately was come up with a set of revisions. And my goal in doing that, because it for whatever reason, ended up that the partners in charge of both those clients ended up coming to me. My goal was to increase the offerings as much as possible and to try and to make it sort of the Macau of the West, or even better, what Cuba should have been. So I included everything.
Well, you got a couple of big casino properties in the Bahamas, right? I mean,
well, and
I
thought they should regulate all forms of gambling and allow all forms. So I was including things like FFO.
I remember. It was I thought it was one of the most comprehensive frameworks for a country ever. Like, it literally covered the breadth of all these things and permitted the country to be able to regulate and turn on and off and decide which of these, like, multitudinous gaming opportunities that keep expanding. Is it FFO? Is it this? Is it the horse racing?
Well,
online? Is it not online? And they were able to, because I remember reading it one time, I was like, this is amazingly comprehensive and clean. And it's like, you know, it, really cool technical and operational features as well. I can locate in the Bahamas, get a license, and face outwardly for my online casinos.
Well, you can, as long as the jurisdiction's okay with it. And the other thing is that the idea would be some sort of reciprocity with jurisdictions that actually have rigorous licensing processes. So a company like, IGT was already licensed there, but, you know, take a look at Ainsworth or somebody like that. Rather than having to go through the cumbersome licensing process, is you could, you know, if you had a jurisdiction like Nevada or New Jersey, the regulators there could grant you a license based on that and conditioned upon your continued good standing as a licensee in those jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And the idea there was to get people in the jurisdiction as quickly as possible, because the primary goal, again, we talked about primary policy reasons for the Bahamas regulating and authorizing gaming was revenue generation for the state, for the country. So if these companies have already been vetted by agencies that have resources that dwarf your own, what's the real benefit of throwing them through this process again with a smaller set of resources to actually investigate them? I mean, all you're doing is you're delaying revenue for your own jurisdiction. So let's let them in. And we'll focus not so much on the intake as the operations, which is something I think Nevada should consider at some point in time in the not too distant future. But the idea was to really make the Bahamas as open a gaming market as possible, to promote competition, to regulate in a way that made sense for the resources that they had available. And for things like FFO, because I think the Bahamas are, what, an hour ahead of East Coast U.S.?
AST.
So, which makes them a little closer to GMT, which is where a lot of the financial markets are. So they put a lot into, you know, gambling or gaming on financial products, because then you can then become a jurisdiction that allows traders of commodities and securities to hedge their trades with bets in your jurisdiction. And, you know, you're getting some benefit from that, right?
We say that now, and I'm looking up the time zone. I thought it was on AST, but according to the interwebs, it's Eastern.
Oh, even with Eastern, you're not too far off of GMT.
Yeah.
What ended up happening is it was pared down quite a bit.
Ultimately, it was.
Ultimately, it was pared down a lot. Ultimately, and the political dynamic in the Bahamas is different. You know, I'm not from the Bahamas. I don't understand all the different players. But they had a lot of competing stakeholders, and I would say, as was described to me, gray area operators that were concerned, particularly concerned that if the regulated market got so strong that the gray market would kind of disappear.
Yeah, I mean, I always like to say, like, gambling is local.
Yeah.
So, you know, we see the local impact of influence of existing operators in the U.S. and other jurisdictions as well.
Whether
it's Brazil, Las Vegas, Nevada, London, UK, or wherever else, there's certainly a local impact in terms of what's permitted or what's permissible. And then I also think what's interesting is, like, sometimes politics overlays what would be a really, really good framework to drive business and operations and technology and innovation. So we definitely regulate ourselves quite a bit in this space, even globally, less so in some jurisdictions than others, but it is regulated.
The trend is away from regulation, let's be honest. Even in jurisdictions that regulate heavily or have traditionally regulated heavily, there are exceptions and exemptions being made now, or just not even overt exemptions and exceptions, but there are decisions being made now and things that are being done that 20 years ago would have been unheard of.
What about the UK?
UK again is totally different. In the UK, this is a normal business, right? It's not a privilege license. It's around consumer protections and anti-money laundering. Those are the primary concerns, right? Here, gaming is a privilege. You don't have a right to a gaming license. And that because that and it's at least in the US, that all flows from Nevada. And that was litigated in Nevada. And the idea there, you know, again, this is when Nevada was one of one, was to be able to keep people out that we thought were unsuitable. People that, to be quite frank, jeopardized federal intervention in the Nevada market. The UK didn't have that issue.
It's
Through the
interesting.
UK, it was about player safety,
Yeah.
gambling debt, enforcement of gambling debts, and money laundering. So those are where they put their resources. That's where they seem to have focused. Now, does that mean you could be a bad guy and still get a license there? Probably not, because they do some background checking. And if you're a criminal, you're not going to get a gaming license. You're probably not committed to consumer protection or anti-money laundering reporting. And look at what the fines in the UK have been over. And the activities of the, you know, that, you know, where the enforcement,
focuses.
exactly. It's different than it is in Nevada. It's different than it is in the US. Personally, I think Nevada, it's time to switch. It's time for us to adjust our system in another way. I mean, when we were one of one, keeping people out. And the reason you wanted to keep people out is when you were one of one, you ever see the movie Casino? Watch that movie. The very beginning, Robert De Niro has this monologue where he talks about Las Vegas. And he says at one point, Las Vegas did for gamblers what Lourdes does for sinners. And what he's saying there is that you could, you know, everywhere else in the world, you know, or everywhere else in the country, you're a criminal and you come to Las Vegas and now you're a regular guy, you know, it's all accepted. And that was the problem, is that people with criminal backgrounds, people engaging in criminal activity in other jurisdictions were flocking to Nevada. So we were attracting a lot of criminals. I don't think that's the case anymore. I really don't. With gambling available in all the two states, I just don't see that being an issue.
Back to our original point with gambling available in all but two states and one territory. When you say gambling, you're reading all forms, gaming, gambling, lotto,
Oh,
some form of something.
right. All forms. But even in states where you have, where it's been highly limited, like Tennessee, for example. I mean, Tennessee's opening up. They got sports wagering, and it's, you know, it certainly isn't regulated like it is here. You don't have the same kind of minimum thermal control standards or tech standards or requirements you have here. And that's the other thing, is that while a lot of jurisdictions have a regulatory apparatus, regulatory in quotes, the real truth is they don't really do much regulating at all. It's spot regulation at best. In some states, the gaming regulator doesn't actually have very many resources. You know, there are states where the investigative arm is the state police. You know, and I can tell you for certain that in one jurisdiction that does that, the state police basically have said, go pound sand. And we don't have time for this. So while the gaming statute says the gaming regulator has X amount of days to approve or deny a license, the truth is, and they have to run a background check and get approvals, if the state police are unwilling to do it, they're just going to approve everybody. They don't have anything to base a rejection on. Just doesn't happen. And, you know, it's reality. In other states, you know, New Jersey is a good example. There are people licensed in New Jersey that were violating New Jersey gaming laws right up until the time they got licensed. And that would have never happened before. I mean, openly. If you remember, New Jersey had a statute on DFS that permitted DFS in New Jersey as long as you had a tie-in with a licensed New Jersey casino operator. And okay, great. So it's illegal if you don't have a tie-in with a casino operator, but now you're going to license those same DFS companies to operate sports, even though they flaunted that law and didn't care.
Well, you see that across jurisdictions too around the world. Like, what is the level of importance of enforcing, even though they have maybe a prohibition on the books? What's the level of enforcement? Like, does it arise to an issue that people care about? Law enforcement or putting people
in jail? It does. In most jurisdictions, it doesn't. I would say Nevada's different. In Nevada, they're still, well, I shouldn't say that. In Nevada, if you're significant enough, you may find a way in that you wouldn't have otherwise found if you weren't. Look at some of the temporary licenses have been issued, you know, two year. For companies that, you know, may have some issues, 15, 20 years ago, not only would it have been a problem for them, it would have been a problem for whoever they were doing business with to have that association. Today, it's not so much.
It's definitely changed. Well, I mean, and that's like, what's most interesting about like this two putting units 3 and 6 together is that we're looking at this constantly evolving definition of what is gambling and gambling over not just in the U.S. but globally, right? I mean, in one of the earlier presentations, which I'm sure you've seen or you know as well, where you point out that the definitions of gaming and gambling skill and chance go back thousands of years, right? This is not a net new topic. It's, you know, this is a debate that continues to evolve. I think like the evolution matches some of where we are in history, right? Even the 100 years of Nevada's history is different than maybe the 20 or 30 years of whatever is in another jurisdiction versus a new jurisdiction like the Bahamas 10 years ago putting on something new. And so each of these lenses is totally different, even though the topics are not new.
That is not the fault of the regulator or the people that work in the technology division of gaming control. They have a set of guidelines, right? The legislature has set forth a policy. The policy has been codified in statute. That statute has triggered the creation of regulations. You know, most of our regulations are reactionary, not only to the enabling statutes, but the issues that have come up over time. But maybe it's time for a different look. You know, I'm not a huge fan of industry standards being set by industry. I mean, it can be good, but it can also be inherently conflicted. But maybe it's time to adopt some of that, because the rest of the nation has. And as much as I don't like it, I think it's keeping us, it's holding us back in some ways. I'll never forget when I first moved here, there was a big casino company that was going to hire a CFO or did hire one. And he ended up going to Boeing or Lockheed or somebody like that, or General Dynamics. And he just had a diatribe about Nevada gaming and the invasiveness. And here he could go out and get a top secret security clearance with a whole lot less hassle than he could get a gaming license or a gaming approval. And it probably shouldn't be that way at this point. I think we're losing out on talent. And that was just one example that I happen to be a junior associate working on the matter for. And he was right. He's absolutely right. I mean, in 1961, it made sense. You really needed to know the intimate details of everything these people have done. Today, I don't think hiring a guy that was a CFO at a, you know, computer tech company and now wanted to go into the gaming industry as a move up to a bigger company and ends up going to a large defense contractor instead is in the state's best interest. You know, if this guy's talented enough to be there, maybe we don't have to make his life hell for 9 to 12 months in order to keep him, right?
You hope not. You hope not.
I mean, it's different. I mean, the world of 1959, 1960, 61 is totally different than it is today. Especially the gaming world. It is totally different. We're not one of one. We're not the only place in town in the country. And to be honest, worldwide, there really wasn't much game. You had a few centers. You had Monaco. You had Macau, but Macau was...
Not the Macau of today.
It's not the Macau of today, and it was, it was a lot seedier, to be honest. You're hearing stories from Macau about Macau in the 60s, and I'm sure you've talked to people that were there off and on in the 60s or 70s. It was nuts. It was like the wild, wild west. There was no, everything was out in the open, whether it was legal or not.
Yeah, no, and maybe we can close on that, because like it's interesting to see these evolving frameworks over time and how it really changes the jurisdiction. I mean, Macau is clearly not the same place it was 50 years ago. Biggest gaming center in the world right now that's regulated and controlled on the land-based side. Not even online, just land-based is massive. Singapore is a great example of that. Australia.
Yeah.
Been movement in Japan and Taiwan and South Korea. And so you've got these great countries all over the world looking at legalizing or expanding some type of something. Europe, far advanced in terms of structures for online.
Yeah.
Where they have this predominant online presence in majority of those jurisdictions there or countries. Of course, there's land-based at some level and there's a massive amount of lottery. But then they even grapple with synthetic lottery. So I'm going to launch a lottery game based on a real lottery game, but I'm not a lottery because I'm just actually doing well. So we're seeing this kind of continued expansion of gaming. I don't think it's going to stop. I think technology just advances much faster than the frameworks do. And then we're constantly looking back and we're saying, hey, my framework doesn't necessarily fit, or the games I'm doing doesn't necessarily fit inside the framework. How does that work now? And so I think the gaming industry globally tends to break the local frameworks much faster than vice versa, where the frameworks don't think that's the games. So I that's just clearly going to continue to happen. I just post PASPA around the world, we're just seeing it accelerate massively.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're going to see a continued increase in online gaming and new technology in gaming. The real issue is whether you'll ever see enforcement. Because right now, I mentioned that virtual the virtual sports book, they went online. They were doing it. No enforcement. But, personally, I mean, I can't think of...
And how are you going to find them? Let's say you're law enforcement. There's going to be a task force based out of San Francisco to track down virtual sports books launched out of Silicon Valley. I mean, no.
Yeah, I mean, they ultimately didn't succeed commercially. But they were a social sports book with virtual currency. They went online. They just didn't do it with that spot, the football player's likeness and name attached to it.
Sure.
And but they operated for 5-6 years before they finally closed shop. But you see a lot of this. I mean, I get this all the time with, in fact, I just had a call yesterday with somebody like, well, so and so is doing it, so and so is doing it, so and so is doing it.
Yep.
I need a letter that says I could do it. I can't. You can find an attorney that will give you a letter that'll say that.
For sure.
Oh, my vehicle.
I've seen them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a pretty well-known attorney on the East Coast that will tell you whatever you want to hear.
Sky is green today. The sky is green.
Exactly.
Well, this has been a good conversation. Let's
anything else you want to ask?